Accession number 28355, Reel 3.
You have just gone to Coningsby. It's early 63. You're on the V-Force. Now, just about at this moment, the deal was signed, broadly speaking, the deal was signed between Kennedy and Macmillan to purchase... I was thinking of the nuclear...
I was thinking of the Polaris.
I was, yes.
Polaris was slightly late. I mean, we were going to buy Skybolt.
Right.
And then this was before, you know, after I came in. Again, Skybolt, the problem with the V-Force was trying to penetrate enemy land. Defenses were getting stronger and stronger, so a standoff weapon was required. And by this time, or just about this time, Blue Steel, which was a standoff weapon, was being fitted to Victors and to some Vulcans. And it was an absolute pain. I never had anything to do with it. And there was also, for a brief period, the Thor missile, which were methods of taking the war to the Soviet Union. And
what sort of range did Skybolt and Thor have?
Well, they got Skybolt. I mean, was an airborne weapon which would be launched from a Vulcan somewhere over the Baltic, and would certainly get well into the Soviet Union from there. I can't remember the distance. Mm-hmm. And similarly with the Blue Steel, I think I'm right in saying it had a sufficient range. It launched, if not over the North Sea, certainly sort of getting into the Baltic. I think both probably were designed to be launched over the North Sea, which was relatively benign, or somewhere up, you know, around North Cape Way. I don't know, because I never was involved with any of the target planning for that, so I've no idea. So I think going back to your original question, which was in the early 63 period. Now, we hadn't yet got into, I think Blue Steel was around, but Skybolt was negotiated. When did Kennedy come in 63. So certainly I think the Skybolt thing had been negotiated about that time. But that was, you know, several years ahead. And Skybolt, the Americans then decided sometime later to withdraw from Skybolt, but left us, the UK, with the option of continuing with it. And that was the time when Macmillan negotiated the Polaris deal. We decided UK would not continue with Skybolt. And Polaris came in 69.
But of course the decision to do that was taken in 63. It was certainly taken by the Macmillan government.
Yeah.
And so my original question was, of course, at some early point in your career on the V-Force, you suddenly realised that in the not-too-distant future, the RAF was going to lose its nuclear capability and it would be handed over to the Navy.
Yes. Well, at the time I'm talking about, this initial line, that wasn't the focus of one's attention. I think it must have been a bit later.
Okay.
You may be right, in which case it sounds as though you are right by the look on your face. we missed a year and all this. Going back to Coningsby, because there's a little story there which anecdotally is interesting. Eventually, my squadron commander, Tony Smales, obviously a new crew, wanted to do a crew check, which meant that he would fly as my co-pilot and I'd fly with my crew and we'd get airborne and do a bombing run and various other things and then come back to Coningsby after about a 4 or 5 hour trip. And the aircraft we had, the only one the squadron had, was supposed to be serviceable by early afternoon, and it wasn't, and it wasn't, and eventually we got it serviceable just about as it was getting dark. So we decided, and the forecast for getting back into Coningsby later that evening wasn't good, but Waddington was all right, forecast-wise, and there were other diversions further away. So we elected to get airborne and do the flight. And then when we came back, the forecast at Coningsby was pretty marginal, but we decided that we'd do a letdown, an instrument letdown, and a GCA approach. I would do the instrument flying, and we'd do our letdown to break-off height. At break-off height, there's a decision. Either you can see the lights in the runway, and you then continue visually, or you can't, and you overshoot on instruments. And so we did the letdown, and my GCA approach was right on the button, and the lights came up at break-off height. And I'd been on instruments, and Tony said, I can see the lights, I have control. And he took control, and I looked up, and the lights very soon disappeared into a bank of fog. So we'd seen the lights, as it were, sort of at a slant through the fog, but by the time you were a bit lower, the fog completely obliterated them. So we hit the ground some yards, many yards short of the runway, veered slightly left, and careered in the pitch black, in the fog, on the ground, across the airfield. Still with a hell of a lot of speed on, so I said to Tony, climb, man, climb. Which he did, which is very fortunate, as I explained at the moment. And we shot up at a very steep angle. And if you've ever flown a Vulcan simulator, if you get your speed too low, the simulator then just cuts the power and everything goes black. And I had that impression that we were, so I said, watch your speed, man. And there's an awful lot of bumps in the Vulcan there, so we were all right. And we went to Waddington, which was in the open, and we landed there. By this time, although we didn't know it, I think there's something like 20 wheels on a Vulcan. 18 wheels. And we left at least half, if not more, of those behind us at Coningsby. So when we landed, this airframe, it went down the runway perfectly all right till the left undercarriage was the one without the wheels. Hit the runway, which it sort of plowed along, made a bit of a mess of the runway, and we eventually ended up slightly yawed, but on the runway, perfectly safe. And we got out of the aircraft. We met by a station commander who was most upset that we screwed up his runway. It didn't matter about us. Because, you know, in those days, you mounted QRA, quick reaction alert, when there was a couple of airframes bombed up, nuclear bomb, with crews at 15 minutes readiness, and all the V stations mounted that the whole time. Coningsby mounted it, Waddington mounted it. So Waddington, having lost its runway, wasn't able to mount it. Meanwhile, back at Coningsby, the next day I went to see where we'd actually been. And yes, there was a pretty good mark short of the runway. And there was a track across the airfield aiming straight at R2 QRA aircraft. And if we hadn't got airborne, we would have ploughed straight into them. And I don't think we would have lived, and certainly, well, I don't think it would be a nuclear explosion, but it would be one hell of a bloody mess.
Yes.
And I think one or two of the wheels we'd shed had run around in amongst these aircraft, fortunately not striking. So there was the inevitable Board of Inquiry. And Tennis Mills, who was a very nice chap, I liked him a lot, had had a problem with a Vulcan in New Zealand some months before, when he'd been out there to display the Vulcan. And I don't know the details, but he'd come off the runway or caught the edge of the runway and not done his Vulcan a lot of good. And so I think, you know, the airships and that wisdom decided that he'd better be withdrawn from his squadron, which had the that I was then promoted and given the squadron, which certainly surprised me, because there was another squadron leader on the squadron who was slightly senior to me. He was a navigator there. Not that that was against him. But anyway, I was given the squadron with an acting rank.
Of wing commander.
Of wing commander. So that's how I became a wing commander. And then I was confirmed in the next list, I suppose. But it was quite an experience, as you can imagine. I think it's probably the nearest death to death that I think I've come in my flying career.
Yes.
So one remembers a bit about it. And then, you're right, the beginning of the sort of change in the V-Force, we adopted a conventional as well as a nuclear posture. We got a different nuclear weapon, and that required a different pattern of flying. We would approach enemy at low level and then pop up to a release height. I can't remember the details now, to release our nuclear weapon. And that was a change from the original type of high-level only sortie, where, I mean, we had blackout screens and we were issued with eye patches. And the idea was that you wore one of the eye patches over one eye until the explosion of your nuclear weapon, and then, presumably having been blinded in one eye, you moved the eye patch and flew over the other one.
So, leaving aside this question of this different nuclear weapon with a different release height, if I can call it this way, the conventional V bomber force would fly to the Soviet Union at very great height.
The conventional role, that is with iron bombs, three-four bombs, was not against the Soviet Union at all. It was only nuclear as far as the Soviet Union was concerned. No, this was to do with confrontation in Indonesia. And my squadron, 35 Squadron, was one of the squadrons which was given the role of reinforcing out to be able to bomb Indonesia with 21,000-pound bombs, which is what our bomb bay would hold. And so that meant that one trained in the 3-4 role, and you also did trips out. I think I did two squadron trips out to either to Gan, where we'd bomb up, or out to Butterworth. I think one of the occasions we left four airframes at Gan and took four to Butterworth. And it was a real challenge to get eight aircraft, double staging, which we didn't often do double, you know, it was one trip. And we did two trips in a day, and then 8 hours sleep, and then two more sorties. And you went out to Idris, where you refueled and went straight on to Bahrain, and then out to Gan, and if you were going on to Butterworth. The Bahrain in particular was difficult. I mean, there was hard standing in a loop off the runway for eight Vulcans, nose to tail. So by the time the last one got in, if any of the others couldn't be moved, this one couldn't get taxi out again. So, you know, serviceability or flight serviceability fly was very important, and there was a real challenge for the ground crew and your crew chiefs to achieve this, which I must say, and you couldn't push the aircraft off to either side because the ground wasn't hard enough. You know, the Falcon would have sunk into the soft ground. And Bahrain, of course, is a totally different place now. It was an RAF station. It had a fairly primitive accommodation in huts, no air conditioning, anything like that. And I was always rather glad to see the back of it. Gan was a totally different place. Admittedly, limiting living was fairly primitive, but the sort of coral reefs around, and I didn't want ever to do 9 months there, but to do 36 hours or 48 hours or something was brilliant. Again, jumping ahead slightly on that, many years later I was doing a lecture on the Vulcan and researching for that at the historical branch. I came across some correspondence between the Chief of Air Staff, Sam Elworthy, and his Secretary of State, telling him that this Vulcan squadron on Operation Spherical had flown out successfully in whatever time it was. That was reporting about yours truly, little trip. That was quite a surprise to come across. But as far as I was concerned, you know, my Vulcan cockpit squadron, I didn't realise that, you know, the hierarchy were taking such an interest in it. But, you know, it was part of the deterrent posture against confrontation in Indonesia. And, you know, it was brilliant from my point of view because you were doing a totally different role. It was getting away overseas. I was, you know, having a wonderful time. I don't know how on earth I ended up as a Vulcan squadron commander. I had no bomber experience, no V-force experience. And the only limited flying experience I had was either on Meachers or Hunters. It seemed a really sort of major jump. So I was very, very lucky to achieve that. While we were at Coningsby, it was in the time when TSR-2 was, of course, in the frame. And Coningsby was going to be the first base for TSR-2. So in the last 6 months or so of my time with 35 Squadron, we had to, all three squadrons had to up sticks and move to Cottesmore. So that's what we did. And my last 6 months of the squadron spent at Cottesmore. Which was coming slightly full circle because I'd started, as I mentioned, my flying career, my wings course at Cottesmore.
Yes.
Cottesmore was a very different base by the time I got back there.
Yes.
I had a new runway built. It had been V-forced with, you know, enormous V-force facilities and operations room and crew rooms and so on.
Huge, deep bunkers for the nuclear weapons and
there
sort of
was thing. There was all the special storage sites for all the weapons and so on. So it was a very different, much enlarged base to what it was when I'd first been there. And the 2-8 runway, which was the main one, was no longer in use, and 2-3, which had been a subsidiary runway, was now extended and widened, and the lighting and so on was up to the B4 standard. Dispersals for the aircraft and QRA pans and concrete everywhere. So it was a very different place. And I spent my last 6 months there. In January of that year, I was summoned by the SX.
Would we be 64 now?
Beginning of 65.
65.
64, it was towards the middle of 64 we moved to Cottesmore.
Yeah.
The secretary sent for me, and I assumed this was about my next job. I didn't know what I was, so I was going to be a wing commander. And said, we'd like you to be MA to the Chief of Defence Staff, if the Chief of Defence Staff will have you. So I swallowed a bit. I didn't know anything about this side of the business. In those days, I should remind you, the Chief of Defence Staff was Dickie Mountbatten. And he was going, and I would be the MA to his successor, Field Marshal Hull.
Field Marshal
Hull.
Hull.
Dick Hull, Richard Hull, who had been CGS, obviously.
Yep.
Dickie Mountbatten had been CDS for 6 years. I think he'd been extended, something like that. So his was a big act to follow. And he'd had a special outer office, I think a rear admiral and various others. But Dick Hull's outer office was going to be just an MA1, an MA2, and somebody called a PSO, who was a lady major, who was really his social secretary. So I would be, in charge of all this. All right, if you want me to. And I think there was a certain amount of surprise expressed that this wing commander was coming. And the vice chief of the defence staff then was a chap called Chief Marshal Tubby Earle. And he had me in before I went to see Dick Hull, and said that people are saying, why are you getting this wing commander? And said, well, he must be good or he wouldn't be coming. I said, so I said, well, I don't doubt that. Anyway, I went to see Dick Hull, and it was Churchill's funeral at about the same time. Yeah, I seem to remember agonizing whether I should be wearing a black tie or not. And I didn't. I don't know whether I should have done. Anyway, I went to see Dick Hull, and he was very nice. Rather aloof and not sort of very personable character. But anyway, I got the job. And in due course, I left Cottesmore, moved. We got a rented a house back in Woking. No, we didn't. We bought a house by this time. We just decided we better take the plunge, and so we bought a house in Woking.
So now for the first time your family had a permanent base of their own, even though you may not be there sometimes, or even much.
Well, I commuted daily from there.
Yes, but on this particular
case. On this particular case.
Yes.
Well, it was coming more difficult. The property prices were going up. It was a time when renting wasn't so easy. I think there'd been problems about renting. The Air Ministry and the Ministry of Defence wasn't being anything like as generous, and I thought it was about time we took the plunge. We looked at a few houses. We bought this place, took out a mortgage at a fixed rate, which was brilliant because it was the lowest rate for the time we owned that house by a considerable margin. And anyway, we leave that to one side. So that's where we lived.
Can I just ask you this question apropos going to see Field Marshal Hull? You obviously wanted the job. You were surprised to be offered it, but you wanted it. What, how should I put it, what research, what boning up did you do? How did you ask people what the post involved and in order to enhance your likelihood of getting it?
None is the short answer to that. I don't think I knew what I was going to. And apart from sort of working in his outer office, I wasn't very clear till I went to see him exactly who was going to be there. I did have the advantage of sharing an office with the MA to the Vice Chief of Defence Staff and the MA to the Assistant Chief of the Defence Staff and the other MA, the MA2, I was MA1. So, and because our bosses were, working on the same thing all the time, it meant that that mafia was brilliant. And I think it was on the job training. I don't know, maybe I was lucky, maybe I was quick in their uptake, but it wasn't without its dramas, because this was the period when the whole carrier battle was being waged.
This is the loss of the fixed-wing carriers.
Yes, the CVA-1, CVA-2. The Secretary of State, newly arrived, was Dennis Healey, and he worked the Ministry of Defence in a way which it wasn't used to. I won't say he was impatient, but he wanted answers, and the machine was still, you know, the squadron leader read the paper, the wing commander checked it, the group captain, and was so by the time the question had been asked, to be done and up again, you know, the next question was being asked, or the answer had been presumed, and the next question was being asked on presumption.
Yes.
So it did, I think, stretch the system. And I can certainly remember one of the things that the chiefs, in those days, I think the defence budget was about $2 billion. And the chiefs wanted $2.1 billion. And it seemed to me that they were sort of, you know, trying to push water uphill, and was it really worth it for this? And I was told fairly firmly, yes, you know, it was. I can't remember the details of it. But the other thing which worried me, and I certainly remembered later in life, although when I was in the Chiefs of Staff, it was somewhat different, because they were still single service chiefs then, very much more, but they still are, but they were very much more fighting their corners, in a way they had to. But
fighting their individual
service corner. In their individual service corner. And of course, I mean, I would argue many years later that that was what you were paid to do when you were a single service chief, as opposed to when you were
CDS.
So I never objected to people doing it, but it was the way it was done. And I think it was the way it was done in those days. And you would find the chiefs at each other's throats over $1 million or something, which was ridiculous. You know, there should have been a system which allowed them to stand back and delegate it, or I don't know. Anyway, but so we had Dennis Healey, which was in many ways great fun. I mean, I liked Dennis a lot, but still good friends, you know, whenever I see him, hello young man, how are you, sort of. And while I was, we were of course going through defence reviews, and
initiated by the new Wilson government.
Yes.
Inherited.
No, these are all the Wilson government. Remind me, when did the Wilson government come in?
October 64.
Yeah. And by this time, you know, TSR2 had bit the dust. So the move from Coningsby to Cottesmore wasn't necessary. There were various other sort of programs which, you know, people know lots about, which I don't need to go into. But there was a very good outer office mafia in those days. Pat Nairn, who was private secretary to Dennis Healey, was an O'Radleyan, and I was an O'Radleyan, so that was a point of contact.
I'd just like to ask, Dennis Healey operated in a way which gingered up the system, I think.
Yeah.
How swiftly did the system respond to this gingering and get itself?
I don't think it ever completely got there. There were various ways in which he was tried to, and Dennis Healey had a sort of program evaluation group, which was consisted of bright one stars. Neil Cameron was the Royal Air Force chap, and Dennis Healey, I think, used them as a team to bounce things off, which of course didn't go down very well with the Chiefs. And there were various, I mean, I wasn't always sort of privy to the sort of detail of this, but I was generally the chap who minded the shop when CDS went off on his various jaunts with the ADC and sometimes the PSA. But when Dennis Healy was going to go across to the States and then on around the world to explain the latest defense review, this must have been in early 67, I persuaded Dick Hull, somewhat reluctantly, to take me with him. And we're jumping around a bit, but
That's fine.
You don't mind. Because there is a bit of a story here. And in those days, you got a Comet 4. Well, so you could say got a Comet 4, and you travelled in that across the Atlantic and on around the world. And we crossed across to Washington, and went to the Pentagon, and Dennis Healy met his opposite number. I know his face. Explain all was going on, and it was pretty terrible weather, you know, snow and ice around. Anyway, we got airborne from Andrews Air Force Base, and I think we ingested a bit of ice, but the comet kept going, and we had, I think, been going on to Hawaii on our way to Australia for a night stop. But the crew decided that that one of the engines on the Comet wasn't behaving very well. They didn't particularly fancy taking us across that bit of the Pacific to Hawaii, so we landed in San Francisco. I was then